everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott, and I'm here with Mark Pascal. Together we own Stage Left Restaurant and soon-to-be Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every weekday from 11 a.m. to 12 noon here on the radio, or you can reach us through our website at www.restaurantguysradio.com. You can also get our podcast by going to iTunes or Podcast Alley and have our show delivered right to your computer every time we put one up on the air. Isn't that swell?
It is indeed swell, Francis. Good morning.
Good morning. Everyone should know that we have a very special guest today, so please hang out. We have joining us starting in the next segment, Deborah Coons Garcia, who's the widow of Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead fame, and she's also the director and writer of an extraordinary new documentary called The Future of Food. And we'll be talking with her for the balance of the show. It's an amazing documentary, now showing at the Film Forum and in select theaters around the country. So that's coming up a little bit later. But, Mark, why don't you tell us about your little trip on the way in today?
I stopped at the farmer's market this morning. Yesterday I was reading the food sections of the local newspapers, and it was covered with pumpkins and gourds and everybody getting ready for the fall foods and the fall fruits. And I was thinking, but hey, it's still summer. It's 85 degrees.
We have a late season.
Here in New Jersey, I mean, we literally have an 85-degree day today. Some of these fruits didn't start until late. I don't know if everybody remembers, but we had a very late start to the season this year. So I stopped at the farmer's market on the way in just to take a look and see what was going on today. And I picked up some white peaches. Why don't you tell everybody about some Jersey white peaches, which are really late. I mean, they must be 3-4 weeks late at least.
And as we talked about in the show over the course of the summer, as the season was late, and you know we all are about our family farmers here locally because that's where you get the best produce, one of the things we talk about is white peaches. Jersey white peaches are extraordinary. You have a lot of fruit still out there that would normally be wrapping up. I mean, tomatoes came in late. White peaches came in late. You have a lot of stuff still out there. So go to your local farmers markets, and you can find out where to find your local farmers markets by going to our website, restaurantguysradio.com. That's for everybody in Jersey anyway. Sorry about you out in the rest of the world. But we have a late season here, and the upside, it's kind of a weird late season. It was a late start. But the thing is, we're running into a late season. We're not having bad weather. We don't have a lot of rain yet. So there's a lot of good stuff out there. And tomatoes are even out there. We harvested...
These are the... I mean, Francis, just to go back to these white peaches for one second. These are the best white peaches of the season.
Yeah.
They are absolutely extraordinary. I got them at a farmer's market in Cranford called Dryers, which has been there for about 100 years, absolutely forever. And they are extraordinary.
Yeah. And the thing about white peaches, let's remember, that's a classic fruit that we need to buy locally because they aren't very good when they're not ripe. Fruit to ship, you need to pick it before it's ripe. And they bruise very, very easily.
Right.
So to buy them from the farmer is really worth the trip to your local farmer's market.
They also have Jersey tomatoes, and heirloom tomatoes are still abundant, perfect, and should be for another 3, maybe even 4 weeks.
Which is, again, very late.
Jersey corn, still running very late. Now, the corn, once we have first frost, will be done. But until we get a frost, the corn is magnificent. There's a lot of late summer fruit that is still doing extraordinarily well, still is at peak season. So don't give up on it yet. It's not time to jump to pumpkins yet.
Well, and what's funny is all the food magazines are coming out with their fall and Thanksgiving issues because they plan those magazines well in advance.
Yep.
And so, you know, you have your beautiful photography out there of the squash and the pumpkin. Don't worry about squashes and pumpkins. Eat your tomatoes. Hey, listen, we're going to put something up on our website later on, which is a little trick that you'll find, and you'll see an ingredient used more and more in fine dining restaurants. It's really it's like a magic trick. It's really a super ingredient. You'll see people use tomato water or cucumber water. It's a very light ingredient. It has a lot of flavor. It packs an acidic punch, and it's really it's great. It's great to use in a number of applications. And the way that you do this, and you know, the thing about nature is, you got to live your life in a way, food-wise, that goes along with nature's cycles.
Mm-hmm.
You can't decide if you decide you want a tomato in December. Well, there are no tomatoes in December.
Right. We've been working too hard to fight against the seasons over. Seems like that's what we've done with food since the 70s.
Is to make it as convenient as possible.
Right. Certain foods are not 12-month-a-year foods, and they're not supposed to be.
But the local produce, what we're doing now is we're still pulling in off a farmer that we've contracted for the produce of his vines, and we're putting up produce. And I think canning and jarring is it's really fun, and it's actually a family event, and it's not too difficult if you do it carefully. And you can get up. There's a lot of good information, a lot of good sources out there. One of our favorite cookbooks is Recipes from Home, mm-hmm. which is by Barbara Shin and David Page, who own a vineyard in Long Island and also a great restaurant in Manhattan. They're also friends of ours, and you can find out how to get their book on our website as well, restaurantguysradio.com. The thing about nature is, you know, it comes in an abundance. I mean, when it's harvest time, that's a, the reason that's a time for feasting is because you would get a bunch of food, you'd eat with reckless mm-hmm. abandon, and you put some up for the future. And in the spirit of eating with reckless abandon, something that really only works when you have a fully, fully ripe tomato, which usually means a locally bought tomato or corn or cucumber, mm-hmm. is you make tomato water. And this is a clear liquid that has the flavor, a very powerful flavor of whatever vegetable you make it from. And I think John George von Richten really moved a lot of this in the 80s. And it makes a lot of sense for the home cook. And here's how you do it. You take a fairly decent quantity of a summer vegetable like corn or cucumbers or tomatoes. You puree it in a food processor. Then you bundle the puree in a cheesecloth or a linen napkin that you haven't used bleach on. Right. And you tie it with a wooden spoon. And then you suspend that bundle of stuff in cloth over a large bowl and just let it drain overnight. Mm-hmm. And what you get on the bottom, and you can even squeeze it a little bit to get a little more pressure, and what you get on the bottom is this liquid, which is it's a tomato water or a cucumber water.
And it should only have a light color of whatever, you know, if it's cucumber water, it should be very lightly tinted green. If it's tomato water, it should be lightly tinted red.
And I try not to heat those things. Mm-hmm. I use them as chilled, mm-hmm. and they're absolutely amazing, either to suspend other vegetables in a chilled soup or to, you know, I put some fish in them sometimes. I'll put, like, if you like raw tuna or rare fish, you can float a little rare fish in them, or even if you float pieces of tomato in them, and your guests, it's like magic. Your guests won't know where you got all that flavor and no color,
really,
and
good.
It's light, and it's just sort of designed for summer eating, and you can only do it at the height of the season with locally grown produce.
One other dish that I want to mention that we've been playing with a little bit that's been extraordinary, summer watermelon, and now we're just coming to the end of that season, summer watermelon with raw tuna. And just a little bit of sesame oil.
Sounds unlikely, doesn't it?
It is the most unlikely combination, but if you get a great piece of tuna on a little piece of watermelon, great, fresh, extend the summer. Let's extend the summer.
And even if you're afraid of raw, you can just do lightly cooked. Listen, our guest after the break is going to be Deborah Coons-Garcia, and we're going to talk about her new documentary, The Future of Food, as we promised. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. You may know Deborah Coons-Garcia as the widow of Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead, but she is also the writer and director of an extraordinary, and I do mean extraordinary, new documentary called The Future of Food. It's a riveting and in-depth investigation into the disturbing truths behind genetically modified foods that have been quietly filling our grocery store shelves, unlabeled and unnoticed. It's also about the rather disturbing and dirty politics behind that food. And Mark and I have both seen it. We're very disturbed by it. It says a lot of things that we talk about on the show all the time. It's a clarion bell for those of you who may not realize that due to recent changes in law, companies are now able to patent life itself. And very few companies are trying very hard to control the food supply for all humans. Do I sound crazy? Maybe I sound crazy, but it's the situation.
You do sound a little crazy.
But it's the situation that's crazy. See the movie and decide for yourself, and the evidence is pretty strong. The Future of Food is playing at the Film Forum in New York City right now in a few select theaters throughout the country, and Deborah Coons-Garcia joins us to talk about it. Hi, Deborah.
Deborah, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
I'm still scared.
Yeah,
I saw your movie last night.
My blood pressure's a little higher than it was before it was a few days ago.
Don't be sorry. Everyone should be. You know, can you talk to us? I mentioned in my introduction of you recent changes in law about patenting and patenting living organisms.
What's interesting is actually it wasn't a change in the law. It was a ruling by the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
and so it actually didn't get voted on. And what they allowed was for life to be patented. So in the United States, corporations can patent seeds, they can patent DNA, they patent human DNA, they've genetically engineered a mouse called the Harvard mouse has a tendency to get cancer, and that mm-hmm. animal is patented. So there's all kinds of things being patented, especially the one, you know, patenting human genes is a problem. They are also patenting processes, breeding processes that have been in that people have been using for generations.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the ramifications of that. Why is it such a bad thing to, let's say, patent a wheat seed or a mouse?
Well, I mean, what they used to be able in the 70s, there were breeders could patent their work. Plant breeders could patent their work because they actually did develop something. But there were three exceptions to that. Farmers could replant those seeds. They could trade those seeds with other farmers, and people could do research on them. And because of a ruling that was made in the 1980s regarding a genetically engineered organism, now they can patent using utility patents, which means that you can't use the patented DNA in any way. So one ramification is that is if those pollen from those patented seeds or those seeds themselves blow onto your property and grow there, you're actually breaching the patent of the corporation that owns that DNA.
Let's put this another way for our listeners. What's changed is that you can not only now patent a certain breeding process to breed a certain type of seed or a certain type of animal, you now own the animal and that nature of animal and all of its progeny forever as long as that gene is in its children. Is that
you own it for the life of the patent, which is like usually 20 to 30 years.
That seems like a really long time. That's you know, 20 generations of sheep.
Well, what's disturbing about it in terms of plants is that the corporations, say Monsanto, for example, are buying up all the seed companies.
Mm-hmm.
So the corporations that make the pesticides and herbicides also now pretty much control our seed supply.
Well, that was something that your movie hit on, and I really want to get into a little bit more in depth. Let's talk about what a company, and we'll use the name Monsanto because they're one of the companies doing this, what exactly they're doing with the seed population
to control it.
Well, one thing they're doing is they're buying up the patents. They're buying up the seed companies themselves.
So what does that mean, they're buying up the patents for the seeds?
They're buying up the seed companies. They spent $9 billion in the 90s buying up seed companies, and just in the past year they've bought up a whole bunch more, including Seminis, which is a Mexican company that controls most of the vegetable seed that's for sale in the Western Hemisphere.
Okay, so Monsanto's buying all the seed companies. Why is that a big deal?
Well, because they can control the seeds, and they can let out certain seeds, and then they cannot let out other seeds.
So what they're doing is they're not putting all the seeds back into the population. They're buying seeds and only distributing the ones that they want to distribute.
Some of the companies they bought are distributing the seeds as they normally have distributed. Mm-hmm. But the fear that people have is because these are the same corporations that do genetic engineering on seeds, and the seeds are genetically engineered, most of them are Roundup Ready.
Mm-hmm.
So they're genetically engineered so you can spray them with Roundup, which is an herbicide, and everything but the genetically engineered plant dies. All the weeds die. Everything dies but the plant that's genetically engineered. So the fear is that when just a few companies control the seed supply of the planet, and because of this new kind of patenting, so farmers can't trade seeds, and they can't replant their seeds, farmers have to go back to these corporations year after year and buy the seeds, which for some farmers is a hardship because most farmers do replant some of their seeds. It puts them in a position of being dependent on the corporations, and, of course, if they do replant their seeds that are patented, they end up getting sued. So it's a financial burden on the farmers, and also it takes control of our food supply out of the hands of many people, which, you know, there could be more healthy kind of competition, putting it in the hands of a few corporations. And that it's just sort of an alarming, you know, it used to be farmers controlled, you know, farmers and people who actually dealt with the plants and the fields. They controlled the food supply. Now corporations and people in boardrooms are controlling everything from seed all the way to what's distributed.
I think we may be going a little bit too fast.
But let me bring it down to a real human level. What's happened here is, I don't know, since well before the pharaohs, farmers grow a certain amount of a vegetable, and they retain some for seed stock for the following year. And that way we have a lot of different diversity. And farmers, you know, that ideal of the independent farmer, whether it's a for-profit farmer or a subsistence farmer. That's changing over to where now what the corporations are doing is they're controlling all of the seed stock. So it's very hard to find I think their goal is, so it will be very hard to find seed that's not patented somewhere, and then not even allow you to replant the seed. So I grow corn, and I retain some corn to plant for next year. I can't do that. I still have to pay Monsanto, even if I don't go buy corn from them again.
Right.
Is that where we are,
Deborah?
Well,
you actually wouldn't be – the way it works now is you would not be allowed to replant that seed.
Wow.
I mean, you wouldn't be able to.
So I can't take the corn off of my corn
and plant
put it in the ground.
Well, not if it's Roundup Ready corn.
Wow. That's
that they can trace the DNA back.
That's absolutely incredible. They are suing people who have on their land some of their genetically modified organisms who didn't even plant it there.
Yeah, there's a famous case, Percy Schmeiser, we go into in the film, and he was growing canola in Canada, and somehow, whether it blew there or blew off a truck or blew from his neighbor's fields, he ended up with Roundup Ready canola on his fields.
We're going to finish the story of Percy Schmeiser, which is a tragic and terrible story that has relevance to all of us right now in just a moment. Our guest is Deborah Coons Garcia, who is a writer and director of The Future of Food, a very important documentary that's currently at the Film Forum that you can find out more about by going to our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be talking with more with her in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal and Francis Schott of Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick. And our guest today is Deborah Coons Garcia, who is the writer and director of The Future of Food, a riveting documentary about food. And we were talking right before the break about the plight of Percy Schmeiser, a Canadian farmer who never planted genetically modified anything on his property. And somehow it blew there without his knowledge, invaded by this genetically modified canola. And what happened to Percy, Deborah?
Well, what happened is he was sued by Monsanto for violating their patent. And they demanded money from him, and he refused to pay. So he took the case all the way up to the Supreme Court of Canada, and the Supreme Court ruled that he had breached their patent.
Okay, hold on a second.
Okay, yeah, he breached their patent by having a field. I mean, what you could say then is that all of us, if Monsanto drives down the street throwing corn kernels out the window of their car as they go, and that corn grows in my front yard, Monsanto can then sue me for growing their corn.
Yeah, that's it.
I mean, does that sound as ridiculous as it really is?
Well, the disturbing thing is that this came about because of a Supreme Court ruling.
I know.
It actually wasn't voted on by Congress. It wasn't voted on by people.
And
people would want that.
And Monsanto is pursuing the same, and other companies are pursuing the same sort of enforcement of violations in the United States, are they not?
Yeah, they are. They've sent out probably sent out thousands of letters to farmers demanding payment for having patented plants on their property. And most farmers pay because they don't want to have lawsuits.
How are you going to take on Monsanto? The family farmer is barely able to stay in the family farm. That's what we talk about all the time. Now, this big, monstrous agribusiness company comes and says, I infected your land with my Frankenfood, and it grew there. And I think Monsanto should be paying the farmer
for infecting his land. I mean, Percy Schmeiser has been growing his seed, and I take this directly from your movie, Deborah, so if I've made a mistake, please correct me. He's growing canola on his property for years and years and years, collecting the seed, refining the seed, getting the plants exactly the way he wants them by picking certain seeds every year, correct?
That's right.
Now, a truck driving down the road with Monsanto genetically modified seed in it, tarp rips, and canola spreads into his property, and now he's sued for growing their canola.
That's right.
Incredible. Our guest is Deborah Coons Garcia. She's a director and author of the new film, The Future of Food. Riveting stuff. More after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with my partner, Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or receive our podcasts on iTunes every day.
Our guest today is Deborah Coons Garcia. You may know her as the widow of Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead, but she is also the writer and director of an extraordinary new documentary called The Future of Food, which you must see. It's a riveting and in-depth investigation into the disturbing truths behind genetically modified or GMO foods that have been quietly filling grocery store shelves, unlabeled and unnoticed. It's also about the rather disturbing and dirty politics behind that food. The Future of Food is playing at the Film Forum in New York City and at select theaters around the country. You can go to thefutureoffood.com or find it through our website where everyone visits all the time, restaurantguysradio.com. Welcome back, Deborah.
Hello.
We were talking before the news about the story of Percy Schmeiser. Percy Schmeiser is a Canadian farmer who was growing canola on his land, and without his notice or without his intent, some seeds or some pollen from some Monsanto-owned genetically modified canola found its way onto his land. Monsanto then sued him for growing the stuff that they threw on his property. They didn't really throw it themselves, but it got there without his putting it there. You know, bees, pollen, nature, things like that. And they won.
Actually, the way it worked out in his particular case was the Supreme Court up there said that he had violated their patent, but he would only owe them for the increased value that the patented DNA brought to the plant, which, of course, was zero because people don't want genetically engineered canola. They don't want it in other countries. So he didn't actually owe them any money, but he did have to pay his own legal fees, which were several hundred thousand.
Which is a couple hundred thousand dollars. Now, you're talking about a relatively small farmer.
You're talking about a guy who gets on a tractor every day and works his butt off for his whole life.
Exactly. Yeah, 70 years old when he was.
And, you know,
literally spending his retirement fund in order to defend himself
against a huge evil corporation.
Against a corporation that is acting inappropriately.
You have to see the film because people say, oh, it's unbalanced. No, it's not unbalanced. Listen to Percy Schmeiser, the family farmer, and look at his wife tearfully recount the fact that they were just growing their own product on their own land, and the laws are changing. And the reason Monsanto spent all this money was to keep everybody else in line.
Mm-hmm.
Was not to get the $100,000 Percy Schmeiser to spend that money. But they don't care about destroying Percy Schmeiser or anybody else because they want to keep you in line. Listen, is he alone or are there lots of lawsuits all around these?
I think in the United States there's maybe around 100 active lawsuits right now.
So
there's an organization called the Center for Food Safety out of Washington,
mm-hmm.
and they have a really great report on all the different farmers that Monsanto sued. But Monsanto sends out the letters. They've sent out thousands of letters to farmers saying, you've breached our patent, pay us money. And most farmers, of course, pay because they don't want to run up.
Right. You can pay them $20,000 or $30,000 up front, or you can do what Percy Schmeiser did and pay your lawyers $300,000 in order to defend yourself against this huge corporation.
Yeah.
You know, one of the other things that you point out in your film, and one of the things that's very, very valuable about your film, Deborah, is you point out that when people do settle, and they most often settle because they lose, right now it's they lose or they settle.
Well, even if they don't lose, the problem is even if they don't lose, even if someone wins, they've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of money that they probably don't have.
Well,
and the other thing is that if you're an organic farmer and your crop is contaminated with genetically engineered DNA,
mm-hmm.
you know, you've not only are you breaching Monsanto's, patent, but you've lost your crop. You know,
you're no longer organic.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you have had your property devalued because of this. Yeah, you're the one that's liable for it. So it's the system. You know, and this is the way the system is working. Monsanto's taking advantage of the system, but this is how the system has evolved. And I think people need to really think whether or not we want this to continue.
We need to change the system. Just have to do it.
Well, the other thing that's very important about this film is you need to talk to the people that they talk to, because some of the other farmers that you talk to who wind up do settling in the end so they don't lose their farm, part of the settlement with Monsanto is always a gag order. They can never again discuss the case. And one of the real values to your film is you get to some people before they settled.
Right, and they can't discuss the settlement. And yeah, it's a real problem, and the more genetically engineered, you know, fields are out there, the bigger problem it's going to be for people who live in the neighborhood and don't want it.
You know, you say how the situation has evolved, and you know, let's talk about how the situation evolved. I referred to dirty politics before. You have a section in your movie called The Revolving Door between these monstrous corporations who are driving these family farmers out of business like Monsanto
mm-hmm.
and the Department of Agriculture and the other government bodies that regulate them. Can you talk to us about that a little bit?
I really like the way you did that with The Revolving Door in the movie, too. That was great.
We actually used a revolving door. Well, you know, as in a lot of branches of our government, I think we're all getting to be more and more cynical about this. It just so happens that the people who get appointed to regulate the three government agencies that control genetically engineered crops are Department of Agriculture, the FDA, and the EPA. And in all of those departments, you find that people who are political appointments often go back and forth from the corporations to the government, to the corporations to the government. And when they're in the government, they end up making decisions that benefit the corporations.
Right.
Well, yeah, sure. If your next job is going to be with Monsanto after you leave the FDA, well, are you going to do things that are not favorable to Monsanto? Isn't that too close?
It's really pretty shocking. And I guess the worst thing they did was back in the early 90s, they declared genetically engineered plants to be substantially equivalent to regular plants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And because of that, they don't need to be labeled or tested. And a lot of people have problems with that because they would like to have it labeled. Most countries in the world, there's over 30 countries that have a billion citizens in them that demand that genetically engineered foods be labeled. But here, the United States, who actually pioneered the stuff and creates the most of the stuff, no labeling. So it's pretty shocking. And our choice is being taken away from us. And I think right now people aren't aware. They're not aware of what's happening. But it is what's happening. Say only 30% of Americans think they've ever eaten genetically engineered foods, and virtually 100% probably have.
It's in 60% of our food supply, and it's unlabeled. That's why I say it's sneaking into the store shelf. When you look at the president of the United States, and this is not a partisan thing. There have been Democrats who have done this as well. You know, Republicans have done this as well. When you look at functionaries of the United States, talk about how we need to get Europe to accept our genetically modified food. Europe and everyone else is perfectly willing to accept our genetically modified food as long as it's labeled. What our government's position is, we'd rather not sell food to Europe than have to label it as genetically modified.
Actually, in Europe, it is labeled there.
Right.
Right.
The EU has to be labeled.
That's why they won't buy our food. Because we refuse to label it.
So when they go on TV and they say we have to get Europe to bring the trade barriers down to buy our food, they're perfectly willing to buy our food as long as we label it. But we won't sell it to them if they label it.
I guess what I'm saying, it does have to be labeled if it's over there, but they don't want the food at all. They don't want genetically engineered food.
Yep.
So if it's labeled, they can say no to it. And it's an interesting phenomenon over there. Because it's labeled, people can go in the store and choose not to buy it, and they don't buy it.
Right.
So the stores don't stock it, so the companies don't make it, so the farmers don't grow it. It goes all the way back.
Well, that's exactly the problem.
And we don't have that here. We don't have that choice.
Because we don't want genetically modified food either.
Right.
Okay? The people in this country don't want to have genetically modified food, and that's one of the reasons, and we'll get into more reasons why they don't want to label it.
And in a country where we can't agree on anything, 80 to 90% of Americans want GMO products labeled. In the United States, they're not labeled. Why is that? Why do the corporations have such control over government that they can do something that 90% of the Americans don't want us to do? We'll talk more with that about Deborah Kunz-Garcia, who is the director and writer of The Future of Food, a riveting new documentary on food, in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. Today we have with us Deborah Kunz-Garcia, the writer and director of an extraordinary new documentary called The Future of Food. Deborah, welcome back to the show.
Deborah, we were talking before the break, and it seems as though 80 to 90% of Americans want, when there's genetically modified products in the food supply, and it's in 60% of the items out there, want it labeled as GMO, just like Europe.
You just said it's in 60% of the foods out there.
Let me explain that, because the main crops that are genetically engineered now are corn, cotton, soy, and canola, some Hawaiian papaya, and a couple of different kinds of squash. So there's not a lot of crops that are genetically engineered, but the ones that are genetically engineered are in a lot of stuff, especially corn syrup and lecithin, which is made from soy. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of corn syrup and a lot of lecithin out there. So that's why it ends up in a lot of foods. But it's mostly processed foods. There aren't genetically engineered tomatoes or peaches yet. That's why I think everybody needs to pay attention to this issue.
And I just want to reiterate this. Corn syrup is in almost every manufactured product that's on the shelves there.
If it's sweet, it probably has corn syrup in it. It's probably not sugar.
Yeah.
Now, if 90% of Americans, say 80%, let's be conservative, of Americans want GMO products labeled. How is it possible that our government doesn't require them to be labeled like so many other governments in the world do?
Well, I think that it just got declared, you know, this ruling that happened back in the first Bush administration, that they were going to be substantially equivalent. Because they're substantially equivalent, they fall under this category called GRAS, generally recognized as safe, and they don't need to be labeled or tested.
If they're substantially equivalent, how do you patent them?
Good question.
It's your question. I took it from your movie.
Yeah,
so.
I know. That's what people are saying. How can that be? They want to play both sides. Yeah.
Yeah. The point that Mark and Deborah are talking about is that, you know, on the one hand, these companies are saying these products are so unique and so revolutionary and so different that they have a right to patent them and their progeny for 20 years. And they say that to the patent office. But then they go to the office that regulates new foods, mm-hmm. and they say, oh, it's just the same old thing.
Same thing.
Same thing. Yeah, nothing new.
Same thing.
And
right.
And our government says, oh, yeah, it's revolutionary different. Here's the patent. But no, it's no different at all. You just don't need to be even test it before you put it out on the market.
Yeah, and I think that it's really telling that they don't want to label it because they know that people won't buy it. And that's the strange thing is I think people should have the power here, not the corporations. I think everybody agrees, no matter where you are in the spectrum, that corporations have too much power. And mm-hmm. this is a really good example of that.
We take that power back when we start making movies like this.
And developing relationships with local farmers so mm-hmm. you can ask them, you know, well, how did you grow this food? Is this Roundup Ready corn? I mean, that's the really good answer that people can, you know, action they can take.
You scared the tar out of me in your movie with the one woman, I think it was in Oregon, who was a farmer who went out and talked about wanting to have freedom of choice and wanting genetically modified organisms labeled or regulated. And the publicity campaign that the chemical companies mounted against her. Can you tell us about that?
Right. There was a woman in Oregon a few years ago that put a measure on a ballot to label genetically engineered foods in Washington.
Just a common citizen.
In Oregon, I'm sorry. Excuse me?
Just a common citizen and a farmer.
Yeah, just a regular person. And so she got this thing going, and the companies mounted I think it was $4 or $5 million campaign against that issue, and it ended up, even though most people in Oregon wanted it labeled, they ended up voting against it because they kept saying, oh, it's going to cost much more money. You know, everybody's going to have to pay hundreds of dollars more a year for their food if it's labeled, which is simply not true. There are countries all over the world that label, and those countries spend much less on their food than we do. So, but it scared people because people do vote their pocketbook, but it's not accurate that it would cost people more money. It would just mean that people would have a choice, and then the companies would have to decide what they're going to sell and not sell, and they would base it on consumer choice, which really is what it should be based on.
Well, and you know, what's funny is everybody uses the rhetoric of choice. You know, the way that they did, what they did is this woman put out a commercial, mm-hmm. her holding her kids standing in the field talking from her farm saying, listen, I think consumers should have a choice of whether it's GMO or not, and so we need to put regulations in place.
So I love that they hired an actor then to stand on their farm. And
well, she actually wasn't an actor, but she looked just like the other woman.
They hired a woman who exactly looked right. like the other woman to stand on her farm and say, we don't need government regulation. We need more choice. You know what? And they talk about choice. Choice for Monsanto not to tell me what's in my food is not really choice. You know, it's taken away my choice and the consumer's
right.
choice.
That's it. I mean, that's the whole issue, is freedom for whom? Do we have the freedom to choose what we eat, or do they have the freedom to not tell us what we're eating? You know, it's just, who counts, you know?
Oh, I think we know who counts now, but I think that it's important that we talk about what people can do. And it is what this show is all about, what our restaurant's all about, what most of the work that we do pro bono is all about, which is supporting local farmers, keeping local farmers on the farm. But it's also it's about contacting your legislators. We need the government to step in and protect the little guy and mm-hmm. just keep a level playing field here and make sure that stuff is labeled. And so what can you do? You can go see The Future of Food by Deborah Coons Garcia.
This has to be a multi-pronged attack. This no single way will work by itself.
You have to eat local New Jersey peaches when they're in season. And you should go to our website and you can find information on The Future of Food. You can link to their website and find out when it's playing in your area. You can link to the Meatrix site, which is on our site, which will talk to you all about family farms and family farming. And you need to go see this movie. You really, really need to go see this movie. Deborah, will you come back and talk with us? There's a bunch of stuff we haven't talked about. You come back and talk with us tomorrow about
yes,
more of
I'd
this?
Yes, I'd like to.
Yeah, we're only about halfway done, Deborah.
Yeah, we're
okay,
not.
Okay, that'd be great.
We're not halfway done, but I don't think the station will let us do three shows with you. So that's about where we are. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule and talking with us.
Deborah,
you're
thanks
welcome.
So much.
Thanks for having
we'll
me.
Speak with you tomorrow.
Okay, great.
Super. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Bye-bye. That was Deborah Coons Garcia. She is the widow of Jerry Garcia, and she's the writer and director of an extraordinary new documentary called The Future of Food. It is a riveting, and in-depth investigation into the disturbing truths behind genetically modified foods that have been quietly and secretly filling our grocery store shelves and are now in 60% of the foods that you eat.
Scary. Just untested, put in your food.
Unlabeled and unnoticed. It's also about the rather disturbing and dirty politics behind that food. It's playing at the Film Forum in New York, and you can find out all about it by signing on to our website at restaurantguysradio.com. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott of Stage Left Restaurant and soon-to-be Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Ever considered a career in the restaurant business? We're hiring for Catherine Lombardi right now. If you're a food and wine professional or would like to be, you can check us out on our website and send us an email. We just had as our guest Deborah Coons Garcia, the widow of Jerry Garcia, and the writer and director of the new film called The Future of Food, which is playing, if you're in this area and listening on the radio or podcasting from around New York, New Jersey, it's at the Film Forum in New York, which is a wonderful theater.
And really easy to get to from New Jersey for people who are not podcasting, who are listening on CTC.
It's on Houston Street in Manhattan.
You go right into the tunnel. It's about five blocks outside the tunnel. And so easy to get to from New Jersey.
And it's playing there until the 27th. If you're podcasting us, mm-hmm. It's playing there until the 27th of September 2005. Because mm-hmm. Who knows, you could be podcasting us years from now. And when you go, I mean, the Film Forum is terrific, and I love going to see little movies mm-hmm. that don't necessarily hit wide distribution, and it'll eventually come to video. But I really recommend you see this movie. It's an important movie,
is why you should see it. It certainly wasn't about going for entertainment. It was. I went because it was an important movie to see.
But you know, we're being all serious all show today. Let's talk about what the restaurant guys always do. I like to punctuate my life with cocktails, and so after you go to the Film Forum, there's a brand new cocktail club that opened up on Houston Street. It's called the Pegu Club.
It's actually very close to the Film Forum.
Yeah, and Audrey Saunders is a friend of ours, who mm-hmm. is the New York City cocktail queen.
Cocktail queen is
oh
exactly
my goodness.
She
was at Bemelman's Bar, which is an important bar in Manhattan for a long time. She's protege of Dale DeGroff, who's
this place is really. I mean, it's the new Rainbow Room.
Yeah, the Rainbow Room
as
was
far
the center,
as cocktails go.
The Rainbow Room was the center of the cocktail universe for America for a long time when our friend Dale DeGroff ran it in the 90s. And this new place called the Pegu Club. And we'll give you the information on our website later. Thought mm-hmm. I had it. I don't. But it's on Houston Street in Manhattan. Pegu is P-E-G-U Club.
And really, for people who have gotten into this whole cocktail craze, the Pegu Club is just, it takes it up to the next level with some really spectacular cocktails made from really fresh ingredients. There's a glass for almost every cocktail.
And it's a really cool place, so dress well. Listen, everybody, eat well, do good. See you tomorrow. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.